cliffcentral.com.
Selohat Dang is the CEO of the Nelson Mandela Center of Memory and the Nelson Mandela Foundation, and has been someone that I have known for some time. I've been privileged to be in his company, both here and abroad. And it is his job, a very difficult job, to not only look after and conserve and expand the memory and the significance of the incredible person that was Nelson Mandela, but all the things that he's left behind, his teachings, his sayings, his contribution to society, and to safeguard those things not only for the people who are alive now, but for the people who will come in the future, all over the world, who look to Nelson Mandela as having been this pillar of what is righteous and good in society, and how we can improve not only race relations and international relations, but how we look at ourselves. So, Selo, it's a pleasure to have you here.
It's fantastic to be here with you this time.
Thank you. Yes, it's we've spoken many, many times, and I've never actually heard your story properly. I know that you were born in the Northwest.
Yeah.
Where in the Northwest?
Look, I was born in a small township called Kuma, which is close to Klerksdorp. Maybe I should have just said a quick disclaimer to say, whenever I have to talk about myself, I find it very difficult. So when you see me take off, to take it about Madiba and whatever, you can pull me back.
I'll pull you back. Yeah. All right. Why do you find it difficult?
I don't know. I tend to think that life is not about Sello. Life is about others that I try to help pull up. So I remember one interview where I was put on the spot where I had to talk about myself. Mm. And every time I'd then be talking about someone that I met last week, and this is what we did, in order to then put my life in context. So I think it's I guess it's because I find our lives are now we are too consumed about ourselves. We're too preoccupied about ourselves without thinking that actually there's, you are like this small little thing in the bigger scheme of things, that I try to forget about myself and think there's 80 million people who need greater things than me, who've done even greater things. So, and maybe also it's where I come from. I come from, as I said, a small township, and born of a mother of six, who had six kids. I lost four of my siblings early on in life. And I guess the most difficult in terms of the loss of my siblings was when I lost my sister, the eldest sister. Because I left her in not in good health. Then I had to go to Botswana to go and speak at a conference. And just after I delivered my paper, as I said thank you, then the SMS came through saying you need to call home. And I sat down, and then the next SMS came through saying your sister had passed on, and she was the fourth one to die. And I think that maybe shaped me to never have myself as like this, because life is so fragile. She was the strongest person. She would defend us. I came from a rough township in a way, where one didn't always feel threatened, but it could happen that you're threatened, and my sister was the defender. So she would stand up against any big guy whenever one was under attack. And now, this is physical attack, even whether it be verbal or physical attack. There's so violence in society. And now, when my sister died, I think that's when I got really, it was a deep hurt. It was a deep cut. Then my mother carried all of us and made sure that we achieved what we got. And I was the first one to graduate at university. I'm the fifth child of the six. So I have one sister, the little one who's left. And when I got my degree, went back home to try plow back. One of the things that's not really well known is that I was a teacher.
Okay.
So I taught for, wait for it, it's a very important period, 3 months. So I taught for in 3 months in Kuma, and then I got a call from the National Archives to say you've got this job, you can come and not the job first, come for an interview. I went for an interview, and about 2 weeks later I got the call to say you're successful. When can you start? I said, wow. I'm packing my bags.
Indulge me on talking about yourself a little bit, because sure. I promise that won't be the whole focus, and it is a testament to your character. You're the kind of guy who doesn't talk about yourself, because it's very easy to find people who do.
Sure.
But it's also, to me, instrumental in how you ended up being the man that you are now, and having the responsibilities you have now in dealing with the legacy of probably the greatest man who ever lived during my lifetime. Mm. And to have that awesome responsibility must come from a feeling of responsibility for others. I mean, did your mother manage to, because this sounds to me like the story of a lot of South Africans who are raised by these heroic women who put themselves right at the back of the queue and will do everything and anything they need to do, from undignified work where they're treated very badly to having to put up with long hours, never getting any sleep, transport problems, health issues, sometimes abuse, all kinds of horrible things. Yeah. This is a story a lot of South Africans could relate to.
You know, the I recently did something that I thought was important for my kids. So we got in the car and I drove them around, just showing them where I used to walk around, literally. So for what was called handwork, we used to have to walk to a mine dump and get these limestones to make ashtrays out of. So that was handwork, and I showed them how in the past, so I was little, I mean, I was what, 10, 11, we would walk what felt like a whole day of walking. Today one drives there, and it literally, like 5 minutes later, I'm there. I'm like, no, this can't be right. Something must have changed in the terrain. But we used to walk to this place, and you then get to the mine dump and get the thing, limestone, do the your handwork there in situ, and once you've done that, you then walk back with it for you to put the limestone in oven, and then so that it can bake. But sometimes halfway through the journey it breaks, and that's the piece that you're gonna get a whipping, serious whipping in 2 days' time. If you haven't, it means that you must go back the next day. Get the limestone. Next time you put it in the oven, it breaks in the oven because you overcooked it. And so that's the stuff that I showed them. But then I what was more important was walking my mother's walk. Because I'm glad you touched on it, how sometimes they have to go through hell to just make sure their kids get some life. So my first job, in inverted commas, was being a gardener. So I used to do the garden in the place where she was a domestic worker. Yeah, this part of the story I never liked sharing, because it's important, as you say. So I used to be a gardener, and one would get, what, 20 bucks for it, and 30 bucks sometimes, which was huge amounts of money, which would last me for months. So in a way, one contributed to being a breadwinner also, because sometimes then you'd buy bread out of that, literally being a breadwinner. Yes. So then from being a gardener during the holidays, and I walked with them through that, drove with them, and I showed them how my mom now, who was maybe 50 at the time, had to do that walk. And I was saying to them, it's interesting that this walk she had to do, winter, summer, autumn, spring, she would do this walk, but sometimes she'd be lucky and she'd tell me, I got a taxi just as she left the place of work, so she didn't have to walk all the way. Otherwise she had to take this walk. And today, as I was telling my kids this, and I kept on thinking, there is something here that's special because my kids need to know that that granny, their grandmother who today is old and not that old, but old enough to forget my birthday, for example, you know, used to have to do this for me to get the degree, my first degree that
and
I got.
For them, therefore, to live the life.
Therefore, for them to live. And the point that I drive home to people, whenever we talk about privilege, I say to my kids, they are privileged because they will never have to go through that for as long as I live. And in fact, post, because if my mother passed on tomorrow, she will never leave me with anything but debt. But then they don't have to have that. And I think that the key lesson is, what is it that we're doing to help build for those who are still to be born? Because it's important that we not forget that whatever we do here, Gareth, sitting in your studio today, whatever you're trying to do to build this Cliff Central, it's not for you.
No.
You're breaking boundaries. And how do we break boundaries for those who are still to be born in 20 years, in 50 years, to say, Gareth helped open doors that we never thought possible? And I think that's the thing. As I took my kids through, and then at some point, my son, who's now eight, who just turned eight, then asked me, but why did she have to walk? I mean, there's cars everywhere. And that's the thing about memory and the importance of my work. My work is about memory. It's to say, how do we remember, not for the past's sake, but for our kids today to understand that this is what we had to go through, but not as an instrument of punishment. Recently I said, history is used, currently used as an instrument of punishment. You are slapped on the head whenever you raise any questions that are uncomfortable. You're slapped on the head to say, you were not there. Just shut up and enjoy what you've got at the moment. Actually, why are you asking these questions? That's what we went through. You wouldn't ask your mother, why does the sun rise from that side? It's life. Just get on with
it. Slap you in the head.
You know, slap you on the head and just get on with it. And that's the thing that I think today, I encourage my kids to ask questions. I encourage them to be inquisitive.
Even a question like that, which is the sort of question that you would hear from an insensitive white person. Oh, why did she walk? It sounds like that, right? Your kid actually would ask, not because they're intending to offend, but if a white guy said that to you, you'd be kind of offended by his question, because it shows a level of insensitivity, of disconnection from how people really lived.
You know, Gareth, we had a chat with the chairman of the board, Prof. Njabulo Ndebele, just a few days ago, Tuesday, and we were saying we have to have a dialogue at the foundation. We're going to convene it soon, where we have you and me, same age mates, talk about our journeys. There would be similarities, but those differences are just as important because they shape who we are. And then we go a decade earlier, those who are in their 50s, say, where were you in this age when I went through this? We go back another decade earlier to those who are in the 60s. Say, where were you? Because this, why we came to this conclusion is, we just had a chat now, you and I, about the sports minister's decision.
And about transformation.
Transformation. Yeah.
You've just written about it in the latest newsletter.
Newsletter, yeah. And by the way, these things are heavy on your shoulders. I was oppressed for a good 3 days before I could write the way I did this.
Let me just explain, because I read it last night again in preparation for seeing you today. And I don't want to paraphrase you incorrectly, but basically you're saying we need to accelerate this transformation. And the kinds of platitudes that have been put out there, that these soft solutions are not doing the job, and there are people who pretend to be proponents of transformation who actually don't really care. they think that they've done enough if they have a handshake with someone, or if they gave some charity, some alms to the poor. You know, it's kind of this idea of patronizing. Here's a slap on the back. Now you're okay. You're equal to me.
Precisely. And I used one line. I think that line is the one that I particularly felt heavy on my shoulders, about transformation in my terms. If you remember, there's that line. Mm-hmm. And it's an important line because all of us agree. We are all for transformation.
Mm-hmm.
But then just don't touch the stuff that's dear to me.
Yeah.
Because once you touch the stuff that's dear to me, you actually...
The transformation, but I don't want to sacrifice anything.
I don't want to sacrifice anything. build afresh.
Yeah.
If, in fact...
Name your own roads.
Name your own roads once you've built them.
Right.
And please, while you're at it, maybe you could even build your own team. Rugby team.
Uh-huh.
Just don't touch the one that's there, and now you are saying...
Separate development, effectively.
Just, please, because now...
We know where that argument goes.
And for me, the key here, Gareth, is the heaviness of memory, the heaviness of saying the unsayable can be oppressive. And that oppression is the one that you're talking about when you're saying... If the question was asked by some insensitive white guy who says, why did she have to walk? It's the difficulty of going into those difficult areas of saying, those are sacred sometimes. And I realized that because when my son starts asking me these questions, he's now going into those sacred spaces. And I think it's important that we keep going there. Because it's only when we can build a different country.
Well, you talk about memory, and this is such an important part of what you do. And I think that your story is instructive too, because I think we all do, a little hopeless when you hear about how much conflict and anger and disagreement there is out there. And obviously that stuff is amplified by the media. It's amplified by politicians. They all have their agendas. The media wants to sell newspapers, and they want to sell a digital copy, and they want to make a noise on radio because it gets them ratings. The politicians want, it's an election year, they want votes. They'll do whatever it takes. They'll divide and conquer where they need to.
Mm.
And all of this is quite cynical.
Yep.
And for someone like you in your position, I think a lot of people in this vacuum of leadership are looking to people like you, which puts an extra burden on your shoulders. So when you write a newsletter like this, you know you're going to make enemies. But you have to do it, right? That's what a leader does.
Look, the fact that we keep pussyfooting about transformation is where we are today. We're pussyfooting about it. You know, we want to transform, but let's not do this at the expense of. And I want to remind the listeners out there, Gareth, that we must be reminded that in 1994, we kept on talking about black aspirations and white fears. When will white fears ever end?
Yeah.
Because black aspirations seem to be to eternity.
Yeah. You know, that's good. That's a positive thing.
It's a positive thing. And surely fears must then come to an end so that we have aspirations.
You know, I wrote about this a while ago because I thought about the same thing. So it's interesting that you bring it up. And this is not for me to tell you what I'm thinking, but we'll talk about you in a second. I just think it bears mentioning. White people in this country are also, and Madiba even said it, they have been the victims of oppression too, because being in the position where, and I'm by no means equating them, I'm just saying that it's a different kind of oppression. When you are the oppressor, you're a slave to a bunch of ideals that are not necessarily going to be healthy for you. And white people in this country have mostly come in the long history of our country from being chased out of somewhere else. Very few of them voluntarily left as, you know, happy-go-lucky travelers. Mm. No one boarded ships in the 1800s and thought, this is going to be a fun journey. They were being chased and persecuted and prosecuted and hounded out and all kinds of other things. And I think that victim mentality never really left, particularly for Afrikaans people who then, when they did get here, were chased around by the English. And they had to contend with black people who also said, what are you doing in my territory? Mm. And, you know, the hideous stories in our history, like King Hintsa, for example, that we should be very ashamed about.
Yep.
All of these things build up to a contest of victim mentalities, which is not constructive.
You know, I'm glad that you brought this subject of new victimhood.
Mm.
I dream of a country where we won't have victims, but we'll have continuous victors. We'll say, I built this, it's mine for us to share. And that kind of mentality will change how we even see each other. Because I listen to particularly some Afrikaner groups in informations, those informations. And I listen to how,
we are being persecuted.
I'm now really
our language,
a victim.
Yeah.
The land is now
affirmative
an issue.
Action.
And all these calls which need to be harnessed, the energy needs to be harnessed differently. And I recently got into a serious argument with one person about that victim mentality. And I said, for someone who today has to look after 14, 15 people who are not related to me out of my salary, someone who today, as we speak, I'm renovating my mother's house.
Mm-hmm.
In order for it to not have those massive cracks that were caused by the recent tremor. Someone who does all those things, and I should feel like a victim, that I shouldn't be here, because you keep telling me about how hard your mother worked, how hard your father worked. My mother worked 10 hours a day, but she has nothing to show for it but me, as a product of her 10 hours of work.
That's a powerful
And that's that for me. It's a thing that I always want people to remember, that my mother today is living off a pension, state pension. When some can keep saying, no, my dad worked hard and he's got this massive land. Mm. My mother doesn't have that. If you demonstrated hard work, she should be owning half of South Africa. Mm. But she's not. And there's a history to that. There's a context to it. And that context must never be forgotten. Don't feel like a victim today because you're not getting these things.
You just said something that made me think, and this is actually, I was going to pick up the phone the other day and ask you about this because it irritates me. History and context. Now, as an archivist, as a person who is responsible for keeping the center of memory going and continually adding to it, does it drive you as mad as it drives me? This revisionist history that's going on around what happened in 1994 and before that, with Madiba in particular, I find that there are a couple of elements there are people who are just not prepared to read the history. They're not prepared, and a lot of this is on film even. So you don't have to. You can get it on YouTube. You can see what happened. You can see what this man did. He laid down 27 years of his own life, and not even just him, but the African National Congress, the unions, the UDF, all these parties that made it happen at CODESA, and all of these things that people are willing to throw away, and they say, oh, you know, Madiba was just an appeaser. He was too much into conciliation and not enough into revenge, and let's restitute this and let's claim that and let's grab that. At the time, he could not have done better.
You know, Gareth said, maybe I should respond in two ways. I was recently told by someone from these formations who told me that we should be grateful to white Afrikaners for what happened in 1994, because they voluntarily said yes to transition, that we need this transition, and they were given the referendum and they said yes. Talk about revisionism. the second one is the one of Madiba being branded a sellout.
Mm.
At the time that it happened last year, we had seen that the bubblings, that it was coming. And we came out as the foundation saying, we are not here to protect Madiba's legacy, to defend it and say what he did right and what he didn't do right, because the legacy stands for itself. I mean, you just have to put it against any test, and it will fail some, but it will pass most. Mm. And the prof gives this example of Madiba's meeting with Viljoen, General Viljoen.
Yeah, Constant Viljoen, I remember him.
And he gives that example to say, here's Madiba, who then calls Constant Viljoen and say, let's have a coffee and talk about what we actually want out of this country. He then reminds Constant Viljoen that you might have the most sophisticated weaponry to kill as many black people as you want, but the international community won't let you. And our people will continue to rise against that. So we have two choices here. You and I could just agree that we can never see eye to eye in terms of some aspects of history and how we should build this country. But two things which are options are, the one is we just say, let's build this thing together. Or the other one is an option of
war of attrition.
War, where this country then will be reduced to rubble and then will take decades to try rebuild it. And fortunately, he then chose the construction route. Let's build. And he then formed a party and then he joined the elections. And that part, it's important that we not ignore. And also, most of the loudest voices are actually ignorant about some of the things that happened during that time.
That's the problem. And Mango Sutu Buthelezi, the fact that he had to, with the IFP who didn't want to come in, then did want to come in, then didn't want to come in. We had all that violence in hostels all yep. over. It was a very, very dangerous time in South Africa.
Look
there was
at the
all-out violence.
The provinces. How did we get to the provinces? It was to make sure that the IFP could join. Mm-hmm. In the transition period. And today you can say whatever you want to say, but remember the history. Why did we do what we did? For every step that we took as a country, we had to take that step.
As an archivist, again, when you put together exhibitions and when you gather together this collection at the Center of Memory, do you have people who say to you, oh, but look, history is always subjective? Because it is. You know, it's always written by a person. But there's certain things in history that are objectively true. You can read a letter that Madiba wrote in prison. You can read his own memoirs. You can see his own position, policy position on certain things in a very practical sense. And those things are just not up for debate, really, or discussion. It's not like, you know, you find a fossil somewhere in the Andes and you're not sure whether it's this tribe or that tribe. This is a different thing. This is something that there is documentary evidence to show you precisely where the philosophy took Madiba and what his decisions were on things.
You know, I feel privileged. I think I always tell you, whenever you ask me, I remember walking the streets of New Orleans with you, and I always told you this, that every time I get to the foundation, I feel privileged. Mm. Just to know that I can go to the strong room and open a letter and read Madiba's own, in his own handwriting, what kind of country he had in mind. From the negotiations period, you can see Madiba in his own handwriting reflecting on the process. So observing Gareth, there's Gareth, and this is what he says, and he writes about Gareth. And that all that is important because the subjectivity of history is seen, of course, from the point of view of that who's viewing it. But there are some things which you can say, nah, the guy made the decision based on what was there, and he would write, this is what confronted me at this time, and this is what I had to then do. In Madiba's own handwriting, I once showed you this note where he wrote that one of the things that he did unintentionally was to project himself as a saint to the outside world while he was in prison. And he then continues to say, I was never a saint, not even in the earthly definition of a saint, as a sinner who keeps on trying. Hmm. That tells you that he knew that he would have made many mistakes. Hmm. And history, maybe in 40 years, in 70 years, will look back and say, that was a huge mistake. He shouldn't have done that. But the man didn't say he was perfect. He declares in his own writing, I'm not a saint. So if you expect me to be perfect and to have delivered democracy that you want, to deliver peace with all the products that you want, look elsewhere.
And people are utopian from their own point of view. You know, they see it as the art, you know, politics being the art of the possible, where anything and everything could have been done. Unless you're in the context of those times, you can't say that.
And of course, the socioeconomic status of black people, particularly today, makes it even more difficult, because we can make all these arguments to say, look at the evidence. Yeah, Gareth, look at the evidence. And they say, but yeah, I hear you, but my socioeconomic status hasn't changed.
It's the same.
So inequality has not moved in terms of the needle of the inequality has not moved in the right direction to ensure that today we cannot, 22 years later, still be talking about 67% of boardrooms being white.
Mm. Or of 27% unemployment.
27% unemployment. And one in four South Africans going to bed hungry. Mm. That one in six children suffer from severe malnutrition today.
See, the temptation would be there to blame what happened in 94 as the genesis, which is just not fair.
Because it's not true.
There's so much that happened before and so much that happened since that you have to take into consideration.
And that's the point. And that's why your question was important, to say history stands, here's history which you can judge to say, no, maybe we didn't make the right moves. But what are we doing today to correct it? Because I remember what Leon Wessels liked saying, that you can never argue for a better past. You know, we can argue until we are red in our faces, but we won't have a better past.
It is what it is.
It is what it is. What do we do with the future that's ahead?
Madiba died 3 years ago now. And it feels like an eternity. I mean, it feels like, you know, because for his last few years, he also wasn't very publicly engaged. He was a very old man. And obviously, you know, he was not by any means expected to have to take to the national stage and do anything. And people often would say that they wished he would, as if any other 90-something-year-old would be called to do that. It's, to me, interesting to see how people are responding to his memory now. How do you feel that's going with 3 years past since he died?
You know, there's one cartoon in the Nelson Mandela Center of Memory where you have Dr. Jack penning this cartoon. And it's 1999 when Madiba just wanted to retire, to go home, sit on a couch, sip his coffee, read his newspapers, have his children run around him. And Dr. Jack says, you have to learn to let go. And at the point, you've got Madiba who's holding the rest of the world, and it's the African continent is weeping for more out of Madiba. And two things for me are key lessons there. The first one is, our identities are so intertwined and dependent on Madiba, whether it be him in person or him, the imagination that we have of the man, that we cannot let go. The second one is, we need to reimagine South Africa, the South Africa that is still to be built in the next 40 years, that says, yes, he gave us something, he gifted us something. What can we gift back? What can we give back to Andrew Mlangeni? What can we give back to Goldberg? What can we give back to Kathrada? And I have to tell the Cliff Central listeners about my recent experience of seeing the three of them.
Yes, didn't you all go to London together?
No, actually, now here in South Africa.
At the center?
In Pretoria, at the French ambassador's residence. And at the time, what they were going to be receiving was the Rivonia recordings. Remember that day when they got given the Rivonia recordings that the French government has now moved from dictabelled to CD, so that you can then listen to it. And the first one who was there was Goldberg, who gets in, and he chat a bit, and then the next one is Ntate Andrew Mlangeni. And as he walks in, they start, the first thing they ask of each other, how's your health? How are you doing? And they start complaining about something. I've got an ache here, and I just underwent an op there. And the other one says, that's nothing. Mine is even worse. This is what I've gone through. And then, of course, Dada Kathrada walks in. Same thing happens. And they are now checking on him. How are you? He says, no, I'm fantastic. I actually did a walk with these guys recently. But at the end of that, I asked them, because they all know they are old men.
Yeah.
And I asked them, I said, why are you still running? Let us run for you. And I was left with the words from Dadim Langen, who said, until such time that my Creator takes me back, I will keep running because the country is not where I think it should be. We must continue to build it together.
Wow.
And that for me is history. There, you watching it, and these are people who are not making it about the past. They're saying the future that we wanted for ourselves, is we're not there yet. And this tells us something about some of the key things that we should be remembering, Gareth. We celebrate mediocrity too much.
Hmm.
We're quick to pat ourselves on our backs, and that's why transformation...
For little things.
For little things. That's why transformation is so bad. Because you add one more black person... Wow.
That's fantastic. One
wow.
More,
no. All of us is a
major achievement.
This is a massive achievement. Yeah. But then you're not looking at it to say, actually, in the bigger scheme of things, what does it
ocean.
Mean? You know? And that's
and
what
we'll change it at national level, but they're kids without school fields to play on, you know? Look, I mean, the frustration is, I think, equally felt, because the other day I was saying exactly this. I feel like we're in a rut. And we don't want to expect more, because to expect more means we've got to change a lot.
Yep.
And, you know, rather, most people in this country, as much as I love South Africa, most of us would rather, even if everything isn't perfect right now, carry on now where it's safe than change and take the chance of it being better.
And that's the
just
thing.
In case it ends up a bit more difficult.
And by the way, you are a good example of that. I remember how you started this. When you had the idea and You thought, please let's not talk about me. You could have just stayed where you were, just comfortable.
The same
you were
way,
getting
the
a
same
salary.
Way, the same, of course, but I mean, that's a small thing. A small thing compared to what massive things we have to do as a nation.
But
you
that's
know
the
that.
Thing. I'm saying all of us then have to have that mentality that says, we can change. And maybe that thing that's unpredictable, we're not sure how it's going to look like.
Mm, take a chance.
Let's take a chance. We are a country of chances. We've taken many chances.
And when we do, it usually pays off.
It pays off.
Like you said about transformation, and this is the thing that fires me up. And if people focus on the criticisms you make of the process, which are legitimate criticisms, they're missing the point. Because you point to the opportunities. You say, when you open it up, when you open up boardrooms and you open up businesses and you transform the whole commerce of this country, the whole economy of this country, you allow more people in, everything grows.
You know, without naming particular brands, but I look at how business in this country has done so well because of opening it. Because you then take a chance and you have a mall in a township.
Mm.
You bring in something where this representation of black people is 0.01%.
Tito Mboweni was here yesterday and he told me Nampak, he's a director there, he said that they are more proud of the number of jobs they've created than they are about their bottom line and the number of lives they've therefore
they're
changed.
Because
each of those jobs represents a person who has changed 10 other people
many
in
lives.
The community. Because
yep.
as you said, you're not supporting just you.
And that's the thing that we should be thinking about, because when you open it up, you take it elsewhere where you've never been, the risks are there. But then you then ensure that you cover your bases to ensure that then it can work for those who are around you. And I think we miss many opportunities because we complain. We sit back and see where we've gone wrong.
Love to complain, hey?
And the latest newsletter, it pained me to have to say, please, calm down. Let's cut down on the complaints and say, what am I doing to help build a country of my dreams? And Madiba said, if there is one question that should bother each one of us, whenever we wake up in the morning, we should say, what am I doing to help build a country of my dreams?
Or most people, I'm blaming someone, right?
We find fault in everybody else.
And we find fault also with people who have nothing to do with where we're going. We're constantly looking to blame the president or a cabinet minister or a sports team or some racist on the south coast of KwaZulu-Natal who we don't even know.
And that's the thing that we need to be saying. Let's complain, but saying, what am I doing to change it? And that's the question that bothers me. I wake up in the morning and there are many needs, so much in our country in terms of needs. There are people who write to me every day. I entertain ideas of people who are saying, just give me a break. Just yesterday, I got photographs of a woman in Zirbekom who's looking after 9 children, 3 her own grandchildren, and then the others are children of relatives who have died, and now she's looking after them. And she's losing her house as we speak because the house was hit by a storm, and now they live in this shack, but the land has been sold to somebody else. And they have to now move out of that land. To where? These are questions that bother me every day. And this woman represents many, many, many others who need that kind of help.
You often refer to the work that you did in the South African Human Rights Commission as a spokesperson there. That stuff sharpened you, that made you who you are in so many ways. Because it must have been a tough business. At the time you were there, we were dealing with some obvious and egregious social ills that hadn't been confronted before.
Yeah, you know, I'm grateful.
Like the story you tell me now.
I'm grateful to the commission because Chapter 9 institutions, all of them, Public Protector, Human Rights Commission, Gender Commission.
They do great work.
They do fantastic work. Minimal resources, but they do fantastic work.
And it's a heavy lifting.
Heavy lifting that we need to be always wondering, how do they do it? And I remember how it opened my eyes on two or three fronts. First one is our ignorance in terms of the human rights structures that we have. And our human rights in terms of what has been built is the most fantastic that we can have. It's about claiming those rights. We have to keep claiming them. The second one is, while claiming them, remember how the limitations thereof. You cannot, for example, resort to violence where you decide this is now something. Vuan is a good example. And I recently, thanks for bringing Vuan up, because I recently raised the contradictions in our country. You have people who burned down those schools, but then we forget that there were parents who protected those schools, slept overnight in those schools just to make sure that they don't get bent down during the night. So that contradiction tells you that there are people in our country, maybe even the vast majority, who are saying we want to build.
Of course the vast majority. This is the whole point. We allow a couple of loudmouths, racist right-wingers, extreme left-wingers who only have their own agenda to try and force a point. Everybody's got problems in between, but the majority of us want to build a future together. It's only those people on the extremes who want to destroy everyone's future because they believe in something.
And that's why I always want to remind people about a letter that Madiba once wrote, 1969. This I repeat whenever I can, because it's easy to be hopeless. You touched on this earlier on about how it's easy to despair. You can just end up saying, no, I've tried everything.
This is not my fight.
This is not me. It needs to be somebody else's fight. But it is your fight. So 1969, Madiba writes to his daughters. And he starts off by talking about their education. And that's why whenever we play around with education, it pains me. Because every letter that you read of Madiba, he will touch on the issue of education. His children and those that he knew around them. Then he continues to tell them about how he's looking forward to spending the rest of his living years with them, reminding them that in a letter that he'd written back to them in 1966, he had said that the white judge who had declared that he should die in prison. But then nobody knows when I'll be out of prison, Madiba says. But I look forward to those days which I'll spend with you. And then he ends off that letter by saying, don't worry about me now. I'm happy, I'm well, and full of hope and strength. Now, 1969.
That was at the beginning of his sentence.
I mean, that was the beginning. He still had 20 more years to go. 20 more years to go. So whenever you then want to despair.
Think about him.
You think about that. And you think, if he had he carried hope in 69 and he only came out of prison in 1990, surely I have no reason to despair. I'm not in prison. I'm free in terms of my thinking.
You don't live in a country where the laws are massively against
you. Which clamp you down.
Yeah.
Many things go wrong, but a lot go right. And in terms of the governing structures that are there, we've got it all.
And we've come a long
way. Let's make it work.
Now, Cello, speak of Madiba personally, because I know that you did have dealings with him in the beginning of your tenure at the foundation, and right to the end, obviously. And you had to preside over, you know, the end of his life, but also the formation of things like the Center of Memory. What was Madiba's feeling about his legacy towards the end? What did he want it to be?
You know, if there's one key lesson we can learn from Madiba is how he never actually prescribed around his legacy.
Really?
He was asked the question, how do you want to be remembered?
Yeah.
Direct question like that. And he said, paraphrase him, he said, one can never declare how you want to be remembered. It's for those who are still to come to say, this was such and such a man. But all I need is for them to say, I tried my best. And in terms of his legacy, he never prescribed at all. And it was about us having to define it, us having to... in fact, he even declared to my colleagues that you need not even defend me. You know, I can put it out there and then let history judge it for itself, for what it is. And I think...
Peer review, huh?
And I think it's important. There's a peer review process. You then say, this is a guy who says, here it is, make what you want out of it. And people are now reimagining it. And it coming under any kind of attack is important, because it says to all of us, what do we need to do differently?
Mm.
What, in terms of his efforts, he came short.
But this is what I want to ask you, and this is a tough question too. I don't want you to imagine what he would have said, because that would be impossible. But according to the things you've read, the principles that you know that he stood for, what you just told me about Andrew Mlangeni, do you think that Madiba would say, if he'd lived to 200 years old, the same thing that Andrew Mlangeni said, that when my creator takes me back, that's when my work will be finished? Or do you think he would have said, you know what, I've done what I can, you guys are on your own?
You know, remember Madiba retired three times.
Yeah.
He retired three times. And all three times, he tried first time to say, don't call me, I'll call you.
Right.
In fact, the first time was when he left Parliament. He said, I'll serve one term. At the end of the term, he said, I'm now going to be unemployed.
Right.
Something that caused a huge row, if you remember. And then he said, I'm going to be unemployed. I might be on the side of the street, but I'm just going to be spending time with my kids. Next, the following week, he was already establishing the foundation to try help build the country. Second time was when he said, don't call me, I'll call you. 2004, we continued calling.
And he responded. Yeah.
He responded every time. Third time was 2008 in London, when he said, it's in your hands now. And I think it's important that as we reimagine Madiba's legacy, and what he would most probably have said is, it never ends. The long war continues. But it must be continued by those who are coming through. You remember how he finished off Long Walk to Freedom? The last paragraph there, he says, you can climb the highest mountain. You then get to the end and you think you've conquered it all. You look down, you see many more valleys and mountains to climb. And I think that's the mentality we should carry as a country, to say.
How are we doing, though? How are we doing right now?
Look, I think there are many problem areas. And we alluded to most of them. The issue of today, the issue of transformation, the issue of racism, inequality, and poverty.
Mm.
And I think those last two, poverty and inequality, are going to be our downfall. Because until such time that we deal with young people who are unemployed, who have nothing to lose, you have to always have people who have something to lose.
Yeah.
Madiba had his life to lose when he said, I'm willing to die for my principles. Today, actually, you can imprison me. I have nothing to lose. I don't have a cat. I don't have a dog. And, and that's what we then have to create something for young people to lose and say, I want to build because I have a lot to lose. So poverty and inequality, we must do everything possible to deal with those. And Gareth, any assessment that you give to our country will come out with a lot of problems, but those two will come out tops because the levels of inferiority complex that are there and superiority that's there, it's because of seeing that, well, a few things have changed, but being a white person in a country,
mostly the same. In fact, probably better.
And I think it's important that we remember that young people always remind us, my mother was here, and that has not changed. But I always remind them, she was in a worse position. South Africa today is a better country than it was.
How does your mother feel about what you are doing now and the work that you carry out? She must have an idea of how significant and important this role that you're playing is.
You know, my mom, I can say that she's proud about what we're trying to do at the moment. But then she's also just as proud about our country because she knows where she comes from. She knows that our country was the worst country. And today she can go anywhere without being asked, why are you here? She can jump in her son's car and being driven around. And that she's guaranteed of her pension without questions. The indignity, of course, comes with these long queues that we still see. And I always talk about this because there's something that Professor Janssen calls knowledge in the blood. And I South Africans must always remember that. And I give this story as something that I went through. In the late 80s, early 90s, I went to do my ID, having tried to do my ID many a times. And whenever black people insist that you should call them what they are, you should spell what's written. If it's S-E-L-L-O, it should be like that. It's knowledge in the blood because, in my case, Home Affairs misspelled my name over and over, and I refused to have to take a name that was not mine. My surname, they did the same. After the umpteenth time of this happening, they then demanded to see my mom. Must have left our house around 5 to go there because we were thinking that we won't have queues, two or three taxis to get to the place. And at the end of that, we then had still found a long queue. We stood on that queue, scorching sun, but you could see white people just going in and out of the Home Affairs offices. They didn't queue. They didn't have to queue. Get served, out. Get served and out. And every time, which happened recently, as recent as about a month ago, that I'm standing in a queue with two other black guys in a pharmacy. And this white woman just comes through to be served. And she gives it. And I ask the guy, I hope you won't help her. And that knowledge in the blood is the hurt that Dr. Mampela talks about how deep the cut is. And that hurt is still there. The woundedness of our nation is still there. Let's deal with the wounds. Understanding where we come from, because that knowledge, every time you see something, you think, I'm not going to take this nonsense. Because I saw my mother go through it. At the time, she couldn't do anything about it. But today, I can.
Yeah.
I can do something about it. And that's the difference that we should remember, that our young people have shown us that you can do something about it. Doesn't matter how mighty the government might be, you can do something about it. A university as great as it can be, you can make a difference in there and make people think differently. And that's why whenever we assess our country, let's assess it on how we have been shifting the thinking.
Couldn't end it on a better note than that. Thank you, Sello.
Thank you very much for the opportunity.
Sure. Always a pleasure. Sello Hatang, the CEO of the Nelson Mandela Foundation. CliffCentral.com.